the drawing room, he said. Then he turned around and left the room hurriedly. Goodness, Tessa said, perplexed. What was that about? Sophie chuckled softly.
Well, look at yourself.
Tessa looked. She was flushed, she thought, her hair tumbling loose over her shirt and waistcoat. The shirt had clearly been made with something of a feminine figure in mind, since it did not strain over the bosom as much as Tessa had feared it would. Still, it was tight, thanks to Jessie's smaller frame. The trousers were tight as well, as was the fashion, molding themselves to her legs. She cocked her head to the side. There was something indecent about it, wasn't there? A man was not supposed to be able to see the shape of a lady's upper legs, or so much of the curve of her hips. There was something about the men's clothing that made her look not masculine, but undressed.
My goodness, she said.
Indeed, said Sophie. Don't worry. He'll fit better once you change. And besides, he fancies you anyway.
You think he fancies me?
Quite, said Sophie, sounding unperturbed.
You should see the way he looks at you when he doesn't think you see. Or looks up when a door opens and is always disappointed when it isn't you. Master Jem, he didn't like Master Will. He can't hide what he's thinking.
And you're not... Tessa searched for words. Sophie, you're not put out with me?
Why would I be put out with you? A little of the amusement had gone out of Sophie's voice, and now she sounded carefully neutral. You're in for it now, Tessa, she thought.
Well, I thought perhaps that there was a time when you looked at Jem with a certain admiration. That is all. I meant nothing improper, Sophie.
Sophie was silent for such a long time that Tessa was sure she was angry, or worse, terribly hurt. Instead, she said finally,
There was a time when I admired him. He was so gentle and so kind, not like any man I'd known, and so lovely to look at, and the music he makes.
She shook her head, and her dark ringlets bounced.
But he never cared for me. Never by a word or a gesture did he lead me to believe he returned my admiration, though he was never unkind.
Sophie, Tessa said softly, you have been more than a maidservant since I have come here. You have been a good friend. I would not do anything that might hurt you.
Sophie looked up at her.
Do you care for him?
I think, Tessa said with slow caution, that I do.
Good,
Sophie exhaled.
He deserves that. To be happy. Master Will has always been the brighter burning star, the one to catch attention. But Jem is a steady flame, unwavering and honest. He could make you happy.
And you would not object?
Object?
Sophie shook her head.
Oh, Miss Tessa, it is kind of you to care what I think, but no, I would not object. My fondness for him, and that is all it was, a girlish fondness, has quite cooled into friendship. I wish only his happiness and yours.
Tessa was amazed. All the worrying she had done about Sophie's feelings, and Sophie didn't mind at all. What had changed since Sophie had wept over Jem's illness the night of the Blackfriars Bridge debacle? Unless... Have you been walking out with someone? Cyril, or... Sophie rolled her eyes.
Oh, Lord have mercy on us all. First Thomas, now Cyril. When will you stop trying to marry me off to the nearest available man?
There must be someone.
There is no one,
Sophie said firmly, rising to her feet, and turning Tessa toward the pier glass.
There you are. Twist up your hair under your hat, and you'll be the model of a gentleman.
Tessa did as she was told. When Tessa came into the library, the small band of Institute shadow hunters, Jem, Will, Henry, and Charlotte, all in gear now, were grouped around a table on which a small oblong device made of brass was balanced. Henry was gesturing at it animatedly, his voice rising.
This, he was saying, is what I have been working on for just this occasion. It is specifically calibrated to function as a weapon against clockwork assassins.
As dull as Nate Gray is, Will said. His head is not actually filled with gears, Henry. He's a human.
He may bring one of those creatures with him. We don't know. He'll be there unaccompanied. If nothing else, that clockwork coachman of Mortmain's...
I think Henry is right, said Tessa, and they all whirled to face her. Jem flushed again, though more lightly this time, and offered her a crooked smile. Will's eyes ran up and down her body once, not briskly. He said,
You don't look like a boy at all. You look like a girl in boy's clothes.
She couldn't tell if he was approving, disapproving, or neutral on the subject. I am not trying to fool anyone but a casual observer, she replied crossly. Nate knows Jessamine's a girl, and the clothes will fit me better once I've changed into her.
Maybe you should do it now, said Will.
Tessa glared at him, then shut her eyes. It was different, changing into someone you had been before. She did not need to be holding something of theirs, or to be near them. It was like closing her eyes and reaching into a wardrobe, detecting a familiar garment by touch and drawing it out. She reached for Jessamine inside herself and let her free, wrapping the Jessamine disguise around herself, feeling the breath pushed from her lungs as her ribcage contracted, her hair slipping from its twist to fall in light corn silk waves against her face. She pushed it back up under the hat and opened her eyes. They were all staring at her. Jem was the only one to offer a smile as she blinked in the light.
Uncanny, said Henry.
His hand rested lightly on the object on the table. Tessa, uncomfortable with the eyes on her, moved toward it.
What is that?
It's a sort of infernal device that Henry's created, Jem said, meant to disrupt the internal mechanisms that keep the clockwork creatures running. You twist it like this.
Henry mimed twisting the bottom half of the thing in one direction and the top half in another.
And then throw it. Try to lodge it into the creature's gears or somewhere that it will stick. It is meant to disrupt the mechanical currents that run through the creature's body, causing them to wrench apart. It could do you some damage, too, even if you aren't clockwork, so don't hang on to it once it's activated. I've only two, so...
He handed one to Jem and another to Charlotte, who took it and hung it from her weapons belt without a word. The message has been sent? Tessa asked.
Yes. We're only waiting for a reply from your brother now, said Charlotte.
She unrolled a paper across the surface of the table, weighting down the corners with copper gears from a stack Henry must have left there.
Here, she said, is a map that shows where Jessamine claims she and Nate usually meet. It's a warehouse on Mincing Lane, down by Lower Thames Street. It used to be a tea merchant's packing factory until the business went bankrupt.
Mincing Lane, said Jem.
Center of the tea trade. Also the opium trade.
Makes sense Mortmain might keep a warehouse there. He ran a slender finger over the map, tracing the names of the nearby streets. Eastcheap, Grace Church Street, Lower Thames Street, St. Swithin's Lane.
Such an odd place for Jessamine, though, he said.
She always dreamed of such glamour, of being introduced at court and putting her hair up for dances.
Not of clandestine meetings in some sooty warehouse near the wharves.
She did do what she set out to do, Tessa said. She married someone who isn't a shadow hunter. Will's mouth quirked into a half-smile.
If the marriage were valid, she'd be your sister-in-law.
Tessa shuddered. It's not that I hold a grudge against Jessamine, but she deserves better than my brother.
Anyone deserves better than that.
Will reached under the table and drew out a rolled-up bunch of fabric. He spread it across the table, avoiding the map. Inside were several long, thin weapons, each with a gleaming rune carved into the blade.
I'd nearly forgotten I had Thomas order these for me a few weeks ago.
They've only just arrived.
Misericords. Good for getting in between the jointure of those clockwork creatures.
The question is, Jem said, lifting one of the misericords and examining the blade.
Once we get Tessa inside to meet Nate, how do the rest of us watch their meeting without being noticed? We must be ready to intervene at any moment, especially if it appears that his suspicions have been aroused.
We must arrive first and hide ourselves, said Will. It is the only way. We listen to see if Nate says anything useful.
I dislike the idea of Tessa being forced to speak with him at all, muttered Jem.
She can well hold her own. I have seen it. Besides, he is more likely to speak freely if he thinks himself safe. Once captured, even if the Silent Brothers do explore his mind, Mortmain may have thought to put blocks in it to protect his knowledge, which can take time to dismantle.
I think Mortmain has put in blocks in Jessamine's case, said Tessa. For whatever it is worth, I cannot touch her thoughts.
Even more likely he will have done it in Nate's then, said Will.
That boy is as weak as a kitten, said Henry. He will tell us whatever we want to know, and if not, I have a device. Henry!
Charlotte looked seriously alarmed.
Tell me you have not been working on a torture device. Not at all. I call it the Confuser. It emits a vibration that directly affects the human brain, rendering it incapable of telling between fiction and fact.
Henry, looking proud, reached for his box.
He will simply spill everything that is in his mind, with no attention to the consequences.
Charlotte held up a warning hand.
Not right now, Henry. If we must utilize the Confuser on Nate Gray, we will do so when we have brought him back here. At the moment, we must concentrate on reaching the warehouse before Tessa. It is not that far. I suggest Cyril take us there, then returns for Tessa.
Nate will recognize the Institute's carriage, Tessa objected. When I saw Jessamine leaving for a meeting with Nate, she was most decidedly going on foot.
I shall walk. You will get lost, said Will.
I won't, said Tessa, indicating the map.
It's a simple walk. I could turn left at Grace Church Street, go along Eastcheap, and cut through to Mincing Lane. An argument ensued, with Jem, to Tessa's surprise, siding with Will against the idea of her walking the streets alone. Eventually it was decided that Henry would drive the carriage to Mincing Lane while Tessa would walk, with Cyril following her at a discreet distance, lest she lose herself in the crowded, dirty, noisy city. With a shrug, she agreed. It seemed less trouble than arguing, and she didn't mind Cyril.
I don't suppose anyone's going to point out, said Will, that once again we are leaving the Institute without a shadow hunter to protect it.
Charlotte rolled up the map with a flick of her wrist.
And which of us would you suggest stay home, then, instead of helping Tessa?
I didn't say anything about anyone staying home, Will's voice dropped. But Cyril will be with Tessa. Sophie's only half-trained, and Bridget...
Tessa glanced over at Sophie, who was sitting quietly in the corner of the library. But the other girl gave no sign of having heard Will. Meanwhile, Bridget's voice was wafting faintly from the kitchen, another miserable ballad.
So John took out of his pocket a knife both long and sharp, and stuck it through his brother's heart, and the blood came pouring down. Says John to William, take off thy shirt, and tear it from gore to gore, and wrap it round your bleeding heart, and the blood will pour no more.
By the angel, said Charlotte, we really are going to have to do something about her before she drives us all to madness, aren't we?
Before anyone could reply, two things happened at once. Something tapped at the window, startling Tessa so much that she took a step back, and a great echoing noise sounded through the Institute, the sound of the summoning bell. Charlotte said something to Will, lost in the noise of the bell, and he left the room, while Charlotte crossed it, slid the window up and open, and captured something hovering outside. She turned away from the window, a fluttering piece of paper in her hand. It looked a bit like a white bird, edges flapping in the breeze. Her hair blew about her face, too, and Tessa was reminded how young Charlotte was.
From Nate, I suppose, said Charlotte. His message for Jessamine.
She brought it to Tessa, who tore the creamy parchment lengthwise in her eagerness to get it open. Tessa glanced up. It is from Nate, she confirmed. He has agreed to meet Jesse in the usual place at sundown. She gave a little gasp, as recognizing itself somehow as having been read. The note burst into quick, heatless flames, consuming itself, until it was only a film of black ash on her fingers.
That gives us only a little time, said Henry. I will go and tell Cyril to ready the carriage.
He looked to Charlotte as if for approval, but she only nodded without meeting his eyes. With a sigh, Henry left the room, nearly bumping into Will, who was on his way back in, followed by a figure in a traveling cloak. For a moment, Tessa wondered in confusion if it was the Silent Brother, until the visitor drew his hood back, and she saw the familiar sandy blonde curling hair and green eyes.
Gideon Lightwood, she said in surprise.
There! Charlotte slipped the map she was holding into her pocket.
The Institute will not be Shadow Hunterless.
Sophie got hastily to her feet, then froze, as if, outside the atmosphere of the training room, she was not sure what to do or say in front of the eldest Lightwood brother. Gideon glanced around the room. As always, his green eyes were calm, unruffled. Will, behind him, seemed to burn with bright energy by contrast, even when he was simply standing still.
You called on me?
Gideon said, and she realized that, of course, looking at her, he was seeing Jessamine.
And I am here, though I knew not why or what for.
To train Sophie, ostensibly, said Charlotte, and also to look after the Institute while we're gone. We need a Shadow Hunter of age to be present, and you qualify. In fact, it was Sophie who suggested you.
And how long will you be gone?
2 hours, 3, not all night.
All right.
Gideon began to unbutton his cloak. There was dust on his boots, and his hair looked as if he had been out in the cold wind, hatless.
My father would say it was good practice for when I run the place.
Will muttered something under his breath that sounded like bloody cheek. He looked at Charlotte, who shook her head at him minutely.
It may be that the Institute will be yours one day, she said to Gideon quite mildly.
In any case, we're grateful for your assistance. The Institute is the responsibility of all Shadowhunters, after all. These are our dwelling places, our Idris away from home.
Gideon turned to Sophie.
Are you ready to train?
She nodded. They left the room together in a group, Gideon and Sophie turning right to make their way to the training room, the rest of them heading for the stairs. Bridget's mournful yowl was even louder out here, and Tessa heard Gideon say something to Sophie about it, and Sophie's soft voice in response, before they were too far away for her to hear them anymore. It seemed natural to fall into step beside Jem as they went downstairs and through the nave of the cathedral. She was walking close enough to him that, though they did not speak, she could feel the warmth of him against her side, the brush of his bare hand against hers as they stepped outside. Sunset was coming. The sky had begun to take on the bronze sheen that came just before twilight. Cyril was waiting on the front steps, looking so much like Thomas that it hurt one's heart to look at him. He was carrying a long, thin dagger, which he handed off to Will without a word. Will took it and put it through his belt. Charlotte turned and put her hand against Tessa's cheek.
"We shall see you at the warehouse," she said. "You will be perfectly safe, Tessa. And thank you for doing this for us."
Charlotte dropped her hand and went down the steps, Henry following her, and Will just after. Jem hesitated, just for a moment, and Tessa, remembering a night like this one when he had run up the steps to bid her goodbye, pressed her fingers lightly against his wrist.
"Mispa," she said.
She heard him suck in his breath. The Shadow Hunters were getting into the carriage. He turned and kissed her quickly on the cheek, before spinning and running down the steps after the others. None of them seemed to have noticed, but Tessa put her hand to her face as Jem climbed, last, into the carriage, and Henry made his way up to the driver's seat. The gates of the Institute swung open, and the carriage clattered out into the darkening afternoon.
"Shall we go then, miss?"
Cyril inquired. Despite how much he looked like Thomas, Tessa thought, he had a less diffident demeanor. He looked her directly in the eye when he spoke, and the corners of his mouth always seemed to be about to crinkle into a smile. She wondered if there was always one calmer and one more high-strung brother, like Gabriel and Gideon.
Yes, I think we... Tessa stopped suddenly, one foot about to descend the steps. It was ridiculous, she knew, and yet... She had taken off the clockwork angel to dress herself in Jessamine's clothes. She had not put it back on. Well, she couldn't wear it. Nate would recognize it immediately. But she had meant to put it into her pocket for luck, and she had forgotten. She hesitated now. It was more than silly superstition. Twice now the angel had literally saved her life. She turned. I have forgotten something. Wait here for me, Cyril. I'll only be a moment. The door to the Institute was still open. She charged back through it and up the stairs, through the halls and into the corridor that led to Jessamine's room, where she froze. Jessamine's hall was the same hall that led to the steps to the training room. She had seen Sophie and Gideon disappear down it minutes ago. Only they had not disappeared. They were still there. The light was low, and they were only shadows in the dimness, but Tessa could see them plainly. Sophie, standing against the wall, and Gideon, pressing her hand. Tessa took a step backward, her heart jerking inside her chest. Neither of them saw her. They seemed entirely concentrated on each other. Gideon leaned in then, murmuring something to Sophie. Gently he brushed a stray strand of hair from her face. Tessa's stomach tensed, and she turned and crept away, as soundlessly as she could. The sky had turned a shade darker when she came back out onto the steps. Cyril was there, whistling off-key. He broke off abruptly when he saw Tessa's expression.
"Is everything all right, miss? Did you get what you wanted?"
Tessa thought of Gideon moving Sophie's hair away from her face. She remembered Will's hands gentle on her waist, and the softness of Jem's kiss on her cheek, and felt as if her mind were whirling. Who was she to tell Sophie to be careful, even silently, when she was so lost herself?
"Yes," she lied. "I got what I wanted, thank you, Cyril."
The warehouse was a great limestone building surrounded by a black wrought iron fence. The windows had been boarded over, and a stout iron padlock held closed the front gates, over which the blackening name of Mortmain and Co. could barely be seen below layers of soot. The shadow hunters left the carriage drawn up to the curb, with a glamour on it to prevent it from being stolen or molested by passing mundanes, at least until Cyril arrived to wait with it. A closer inspection of the padlock showed Will that it had been oiled recently and opened. A rune took care of the lack of a key, and he and the others slipped inside, closing the gate behind them. Another rune unlocked the front door, leading them into a suite of offices. Only one was still furnished, with a desk, a green shaded lamp, and a floral sofa with a high carved back. Doubtless where Jessamine and Nate accomplished the majority of their courtship, Will observed cheerfully. Jem made a noise of disgust and poked at the couch with his cane. Charlotte was bending over the desk, hastily going through the drawers.
"I didn't realize you'd taken up such a strong anti-courtship stance," Will observed to Jem.
"Not on principle. The thought of Nate Gray touching anyone," Jem made a face. "And Jessamine is so convinced he loves her. If you could see her, I think you might pity her, Will."
"I would not," said Will. "Unrequited love is a ridiculous state, and it makes those in it behave ridiculously." He tugged at the bandage on his arm as if it were paining him. "Charlotte, the desk?"
"Nothing." She slid the drawers shut. "Some papers listing the prices of tea and the times of tea auctions, but other than that, nothing but dead spiders."
"How romantic," murmured Will.
He ducked behind Jem, who had already wandered ahead into the adjacent office, using his cane to sweep away cobwebs as he went. The next few rooms were empty, and the last opened out onto what had once been a warehouse floor. It was a great, shadowy, cavernous space, its ceiling disappearing up into the darkness. Rickety wooden steps led up to a second-floor gallery. Burlap bags were propped against the walls on the first floor, looking for all the world in the shadows like slumped bodies. Will raised his witchlight runestone in one hand, sending out spokes of light through the room as Henry went to investigate one of the sacks. He was back in a moment, shrugging his shoulders.
"Broken bits of loose-leaf tea," he said. "Orange pekoe, from the looks of it."
But Jem was shaking his head, glancing about.
"I am perfectly willing to accept this was an active tea-trading office at one point, but it's clearly been shuttered for years, ever since Mortmain decided to interest himself in mechanisms instead. And yet the floor is clear of dust."
He took Will's wrist, guiding the beam of witchlight over the smooth wooden floor.
"There has been activity here, more than simply Jessamine and Nate's meeting in a disused office." "There are more offices that way," said Henry, pointing to the far end of the room. "Charlotte and I will search them. Will, Jem, you examine the second floor."
It was a rare and novel thrill when Henry gave orders. Will looked up at Jem and grinned, and commenced making his way up the rickety wooden stairs. The steps creaked under the pressure, and under Jem's slighter weight behind Will. The witchlight stone in Will's hand threw sharp patterns of light against the wall as he reached the top step. He found himself on a gallery, a platform where perhaps trunks of tea had been stored, or a foreman had watched the floor below. It was empty now, save for a single figure lying on the ground. The body of a man, slim and youthful, and as Will came closer, his heart began to pound crazily. Because he had seen this before, had had this vision before. The limp body, the silver hair and dark clothes, the closed, bruised-looking eyes, fringed with silver lashes. "Will?" It was Jem, behind him. He looked from Will's silent, stunned face to the body on the floor, and pushed past him to kneel down. He took the man by the wrist, just as Charlotte reached the top of the steps. Will looked at her in surprise for a moment. Her face was sheened with sweat, and she looked slightly ill. Jem said, "He has a pulse. Will." Will came closer, and knelt down beside his friend. At this distance, it was easy to see that the man on the floor was not Jem. He was older, and Caucasian. He had a growth of silver stubble on his chin and cheeks, and his features were broader and less defined. Will's heartbeat slowed as the man's eyes fluttered open. They were silver discs, like Jem's, and in that moment Will recognized them. He smelt the sweet sour tang of burning warlock drugs, felt the heat of them in his veins, and knew that he had seen this man before, and knew where.
"You're a werewolf," he said. "One of the Peckless ones, buying yin fen off the Ifrits down the chapel, aren't you?"
The werewolf's eyes roamed over them both, and fastened on Jem. His lids narrowed, and his hands shot out, grabbing Jem by the lapels.
"You," he wheezed, "you are one of us. Have you got any of it on you? Any of the stuff?"
Jem recoiled. Will seized the werewolf by the wrist and yanked his hand free. It wasn't difficult. There was very little strength in his nerveless fingers.
"Don't touch him."
Will heard his own voice as if from a distance. "He doesn't have any of your filthy powder. It doesn't work on us Nephilim like it does on you."
"Will,"
there was a plea in Jem's voice.
"Be kinder."
"You work for Mortmain," said Will. "Tell us what you do for him. Tell us where he is." The werewolf laughed. Blood splashed over his lips and dribbled down his chin. Some of it splattered onto Jem's gear.
"As if I'd know where the Magister is," he wheezed. "Bloody fools, the pair of you, bloody useless Nephilim. If I had me strength, I'd chop you into bloody rags."
"But you don't," Will was remorseless. "And maybe we do have some yin fen."
"You don't? You think I don't know?"
The werewolf's eyes wandered.
"When he gave it to me first, I saw things, such things you can't imagine. The great crystal city, the towers of heaven."
Another spasming cough racked him. More blood splattered. It had a silvery sheen to it, like mercury. Will exchanged a look with Jem.
"The crystal city."
He couldn't help thinking of Alicante, though he had never been there.
"I thought I were going to live forever. Work all night, all day, never get tired. And then we started dying off, one by one. The drug, it kills you, but he never said. I came back here to see if maybe there was still any of it stashed somewhere. But there's none. No point leaving. I'm dying now. Might as well die here as anywhere.
He knew what he was doing when he gave you that drug, said Jem. He knew it would kill you. He doesn't deserve your secrecy. Tell us what he was doing. What he was keeping you working on all day and night.
Putting those things together. Those metal men. They don't half give you the willies, but the money were good and the drugs were better.
And a great deal of good that money will do you now, said Jem, his voice uncharacteristically bitter. How often did he make you take it? That silver powder?
6, 7 times a day.
No wonder they're running out of it down the chapel, Will muttered. Mortmain's controlling the supply. You're not supposed to take it like that, said Jem. The more you take, the faster you will die. The werewolf fixed his gaze on Jem. His eyes were shot through with red veins.
And you?
He said.
How much longer have you got left?
Will turned his head. Charlotte was motionless behind him at the top of the stairs, staring. He raised a hand to gesture her over. Charlotte, if we can get him downstairs, perhaps the Silent Brothers can do something to help him. If you could... But Charlotte, to Will's surprise, had turned a pale shade of green. She clapped her hand over her mouth and dashed downstairs.
Charlotte!
Will hissed. He didn't dare shout.
Oh, bloody hell.
All right, Jem. You take his legs, I'll take his shoulders. There's no point, Will. Jem's voice was soft. He's dead. Will turned back. Indeed. The silver eyes were wide open, glassy, fixed on the ceiling. The chest had ceased to rise and fall. Jem reached to close his eyelids, but Will caught his friend by the wrist. Don't. I wasn't going to give him the blessing, Will. Just close his eyes. He doesn't deserve that. He was working with the Magister. Will's whisper was rising to a shout.
He is like me, said Jem simply. An addict.
Will looked at him over their joined hands.
He is not like you. And you will not die like that.
Jem's lips parted in surprise.
Will.
They both heard the sound of a door opening, and a voice calling out Jessamine's name. Will released Jem's wrist, and both of them dropped flat to the ground, inching to the edge of the gallery to see what was happening on the warehouse floor. Chapter 16. Mortal Rage. When I have seen, by time's fell hand defaced, the rich proud cost of outworn buried age, when sometime lofty towers I see downraised, and brass eternal slave to mortal rage. Shakespeare, Sonnet 64. It was a peculiar experience walking the streets of London as a boy, Tessa thought as she made her way along the crowded pavement of Eastcheap. The men who crossed her path spared her barely a glance, just pushed past her toward the doors of public houses or the next turn in the street. As a girl, walking alone through these streets, at night in her fine clothes, she would have been the object of stares and jeers. As a boy, she was invisible. She had never realized what it was like to be invisible before. How light and free she felt, or would have felt, had she not felt like an aristocrat from A Tale of Two Cities on his way to the guillotine in a tumbril. She caught sight of Cyril only once, slipping between two buildings across the road from 32 Mincing Lane. It was a great stone building, and the black iron fence surrounding it in the vanishing twilight looked like rows of jagged black teeth. From the front gate dangled a padlock, but it had been left open. She slipped through, and then up the dusty steps to the front door, which was also unlocked. Inside, she found that the empty offices, their windows looking out onto Mincing Lane, were still and dead, A fly buzzed in one, hurling itself over and over against the plated glass panes until it fell, exhausted, to the sill. Tessa shuddered and hurried on. In each room she walked into, she tensed, expecting to see Nate. In each room, he was not there. The final room had a door that opened out onto the floor of a warehouse. Dim blue light filtered in through the cracks in the boarded-up windows. She looked around uncertainly.
"Nate?"
she whispered. He stepped out of the shadows, between two flaking plaster pillars. His blonde hair shone in the bluish light under his silk-top hat. He wore a blue tweed frock coat, black trousers, and black boots, but his usually immaculate appearance was disheveled. His hair hung lankily in his eyes, and there was a smear of dirt across his cheek. His clothes were wrinkled and creased as if he had slept in them.
"Jessamine," he said, relief evident in his tone.
He opened his arms. She came forward slowly, her whole body tensed. She did not want Nate touching her, but she could see no way to avoid his embrace. His arms went around her. His hand caught the brim of her hat and pulled it free, letting her fair curls tumble down her back. She thought of Will pulling the pins from her hair, and her stomach involuntarily tightened.
"I need to know where the Magister is," she began in a shaking voice. "It's terribly important. I overheard some of the Shadowhunters' plans, you see. I know you didn't wish to tell me, but..."
He pushed her hair back, ignoring her words.
"I see," he said, and his voice was deep and husky. "But first..."
He tipped her head up with a finger under her chin.
"Come and kiss me, sweet and twenty."
Tessa wished he wouldn't quote Shakespeare. She'd never be able to hear that sonnet again without wanting to be sick. Every nerve in her body wanted to leap, screaming through her skin, in revulsion as he leaned toward her. She prayed for the others to burst in as she let him tilt her head up, up. Nate began to laugh. With a jerk of his wrist, he sent her hat sailing into the shadows. His fingers tightened on her chin, the nails digging in.
"My apologies for my impetuous behavior," he said. "I couldn't help but be curious to see how far you'd go to protect your Shadowhunter friends. Little sister."
"Nate," Tessa tried to jerk backward, out of his grasp, but his grip on her was too strong. His other hand shot out like a snake, spinning her around, pinning her against him with his forearm across her throat. His breath was hot against her ear. He smelled sour, like old gin and sweat.
"Did you really think I didn't know?" he spat. "After that note arrived at Benedict's ball, send me off on that wild goose chase to Vauxhall. I realized that it all made sense. I should have known it was you from the beginning, stupid little girl."
"Stupid?" she hissed. "I got you to spill your secrets, Nate. You told me everything. Did Mormain find out? Is that why you look like you haven't slept in days?"
He jerked his arm tighter around her, making her gasp with pain.
"You couldn't leave well enough alone.
You had to pry into my business. Delighted to see me brought low, aren't you?
What kind of sister does that make you, Tessie?"
"You would have killed me if you had the chance. There is no game you can play, nothing you can say to make me think I've betrayed you, Nate. You earn every bit of it, allying yourself with Mortmain."
He shook her, hard enough to make her teeth rattle.
"As if my alliances are any of your business. I was doing well for myself until you and your Nephilim friends came and meddled. Now, the Magister wants my head on the block. Your fault. All your fault. I was almost in despair till I got that ridiculous note from Jessamine. I knew you were behind it, of course. All the trouble you must have gone through, too. Torturing her to get her to write me that ridiculous missive."
"We didn't torture her," Tessa ground out.
She struggled, but Nate only held her more tightly, the buttons on his waistcoat digging into her back.
"She wanted to do it. She wanted to save her own skin."
"I don't believe you."
The hand that wasn't across her throat gripped her chin. His nails dug in, and she yelped with pain.
"She loves me." "No one could love you,"
Tessa spat. You're my brother. I loved you. And you have killed even that.
Nate leaned forward and growled.
I am not your brother. Very well, my half-brother, if you must have it.
You're not my sister, not even by half. He said the words with a cruel pleasure. Your mother and my mother were not the same woman.
That's not possible, Tessa whispered. You're lying.
Our mother was Elizabeth Gray. Your mother was Elizabeth Gray, born Elizabeth Moore, said Knight. Mine was Harriet Moore.
Aunt Harriet?
She was engaged once. Did you know that? After our parents, your parents, were married. The man died before the wedding could take place. But she was already with child. Your mother raised the baby as hers to spare her sister the shame of the world knowing she had consummated her marriage before it had taken place.
That she was a whore.
His voice was as bitter as poison. I'm not your brother. And I never was. Harriet. She never told me she was my mother. I found out from your mother's letters. All those years, and she never said a word. She was too ashamed.
You killed her, Tessa said numbly. Your own mother.
Because she was my mother. Because she disowned me. Because she was ashamed of me. Because I'll never know who my father was. Because she was a whore. Nate's voice was empty. Nate had always been empty. It had never been anything but a pretty shell. And Tessa and her aunt had dreamed into him empathy and compassion and sympathetic weakness because they had wanted to see it there. Not because it was.
Why did you tell Jessamine that my mother was a shadow hunter? Tessa demanded. Even if Aunt Harriet was your mother, she and my mother were sisters. Aunt Harriet would have been a shadow hunter too, and so would you. Why tell such a ridiculous lie?
He smirked. Wouldn't you like to know? His grip tightened on her neck, choking her. She gasped and thought suddenly of Gabriel saying, Aim at the kneecaps. The pain is agonizing. She kicked up and backward, the heel of her boot colliding with Nate's knee, making a dull cracking sound. Nate yelled, and his leg went out from under him. He kept his grip on Tessa as he fell, rolling so that his elbow jammed into her stomach as they tumbled to the ground together. She gasped, the air punched from her lungs, her eyes filling with tears. She kicked out at him again, trying to scramble backward, and caught him a glancing blow on the shoulder, but he lunged at her, seizing her by the waistcoat. The buttons popped off it in a rain as he dragged her toward him. His other hand gripped her hair as she flailed out at him, raking her nails down his cheek. The blood that sprang immediately to the surface was a savagely satisfying sight.
Let me go, she panted. You can't kill me. The Magister wants me alive.
Alive is not unhurt. Nate snarled, blood running down his face and off his chin. He knotted his hand in her hair and dragged her toward him. She screamed at the pain and lashed out with her boots, but he was nimble, dodging her flailing feet. Panting, she sent up a silent call.
Jem, Will, Charlotte, Henry, where are you?
Wondering where your friends are? He hauled her back to her feet, one hand in her hair, the other fisted in the back of her shirt. Well, here's one of them at least. A grinding noise alerted Tessa to a movement in the shadows. Nate dragged her head around by the hair, shaking it. Look, he spat. It's time you knew what you were up against. Tessa stared. The thing that emerged from the shadows was gigantic. 20 feet tall, she guessed, made of iron. There was barely any jointure. It appeared to move as one single fluid mechanism, seamless and almost featureless. Its bottom half did split into legs, each one ending in a foot tipped with metal spikes. Its arms were the same, finishing in claw-like hands, and its head was a smooth oval, broken only by a wide, jagged-toothed mouth, like a crack in an egg. A pair of twisting silvery horns spiraled up from its head. A thin line of blue fire crackled between them. In its enormous hands, it carried a limp body, dressed in gear. Against the bulk of the gigantic automaton, she looked even smaller than ever.
Charlotte!
Tessa screamed. She redoubled her attempts to get away from Nate, whipping her head to the side. Some of her hair tore free and fluttered to the ground. Jessamine's fair hair, stained now with blood. Nate retaliated by slapping her hard enough that she saw stars. When she sagged, he caught her around the throat, the buttons on his cuffs digging into her windpipe. Nate chuckled. A prototype, he said. Abandoned by the Magister, too large and cumbersome for his purposes, but not for mine. He raised his voice. Drop her. The automaton's metal hands opened. Charlotte tumbled free and struck the ground with a sickening thump. She lay unmoving. From this distance, Tessa could not tell if her chest was rising and falling or not. Now crush her, said Nate. Ponderously, the thing raised its spiked metal foot. Tessa clawed at Nate's forearms, ripping his skin with her nails.
Charlotte!
For a moment, Tessa thought the voice screaming was her own. But it was too low-pitched for that. A figure darted out from behind the automaton, a figure all in black, topped by a shock of blazing ginger hair, a thin-bladed misericord in hand. Henry. Without even a glance at Tessa and Nate, he launched himself at the automaton, bringing his blade down in a long, curving arc. There was a clang of metal on metal, sparks flew, and the automaton staggered back. Its foot came down, slamming into the floor, inches from Charlotte's supine body. Henry landed, then threw himself at the creature again, slashing out with his blade. The blade shattered. For a moment, Henry simply stood and looked at it with stupid shock. Then the creature's hand whipped forward and seized him by the arm. He shouted out as it lifted him and threw him with incredible force against one of the pillars. He struck it, crumpled, and fell to the floor, where he lay still. Nate laughed. Such a display of matrimonial devotion, he said. Who would have thought? Jessamine always said she thought Branwell couldn't stand his wife.
You're a pig, Tessa said, struggling in his grasp. What do you know about the things people do for each other? If Jessamine were burning to death, you wouldn't look up from your card game. You care for nothing but yourself.
Be quiet, or I'll loosen your teeth for you. Nate shook her again and called out. Come, over here. You must hold her until the Magister arrives. With a grinding of gears, the automaton moved to obey. It was not as swift as its smaller brethren, but its size was such that Tessa could not help but follow its movements with an icy fear. And that was not all. The Magister was coming. Tessa wondered if Nate had summoned him yet, if he was on his way. Mortmain. Even the memory of his cold eyes, his icy, controlling smile made her stomach turn. Let me go, she cried, jerking away from her brother. Let me go to Charlotte. Nate shoved her forward, hard, and she sprawled on the ground, her elbows and knees connecting with force with the hard wooden floor. She gasped and rolled sideways under the shadow of the second floor gallery as the automaton lumbered toward her. She cried out, and they leaped from the gallery above. Will and Jem, each landing on a shoulder of the creature. It roared, a sound like bellows being fed with coal, and staggered back, allowing Tessa to roll out of its path and launch herself to her feet. She glanced from Henry to Charlotte. Henry was pale and still, crumpled beside the pillar. But Charlotte, lying where the automaton had dropped her, was in imminent danger of being crushed by the rampaging machine. Taking a deep breath, Tessa dashed across the room to Charlotte and knelt down, laying her fingers to Charlotte's throat. There was a pulse there, fluttering weakly. Putting her hands under Charlotte's arms, she began to drag her toward the wall, away from the center of the room, where the automaton was spinning and spitting sparks, reaching up with its pincered hands to claw at Jem and Will. They were too quick for it, though. Tessa laid Charlotte down among the burlap sacks of tea and gazed across the room, trying to determine a path that might lead her to Henry. Nate was dashing back and forth, shouting and cursing at the mechanical creature. In answer, Will sawed off one of its horns and threw it at Tessa's brother. It bounced across the floor, skittering and sparking, and Nate jumped back. Will laughed. Jem, meanwhile, was clinging onto the creature's neck, doing something that Tessa could not see.
The creature itself was turning in circles, but it had been designed for reaching out and grabbing what was in front of it, and its arms did not bend properly. It could not reach what was clung to the back of its neck and head. Tessa almost wanted to laugh. Will and Jem were like mice, scurrying up and down the body of a cat, driving it to distraction. But hack and slash as they might at the metal creature with their blades, they were inflicting few injuries. Their blades, which she had seen shear through iron and steel as if they were paper, were leaving only dents and scratches on the surface of the mechanical creature's body. Nate, meanwhile, was screaming and cursing.
"Shake them off!" he yelled at the automaton. "Shake them off, you great metal bastard!"
The automaton paused, then shook itself violently. Will slipped, catching onto the creature's neck at the last moment to keep himself from falling. Jem was not so lucky. He stabbed forward with his sword cane, as if he meant to drive it into the creature's body to arrest his fall, but the blade merely skidded down the creature's back. Jem fell, gracelessly, his weapon clattering, his leg bent under him.
"James!"
Will shouted. Jem dragged himself painfully to his feet. He reached for the steely at his belt, but the creature, sensing weakness, was already on him, reaching out its clawed hands. Jem took several staggering steps backward and fumbled something out of his pocket. It was smooth, oblong, metallic, the object Henry had given him in the library. He reached back a hand to throw it, and Nate was behind him suddenly, kicking out at his injured, likely broken leg. Jem didn't make a sound, but the leg went out from under him with a snapping noise and he hit the ground for a second time, the object rolling from his hand. Tessa scrambled to her feet and ran for it just as Nate did the same. They collided, his greater weight and height bearing her to the floor. She rolled as she fell, as Gabriel had taught her to absorb the impact, though the shock still left her breathless. She reached for the device with shaking fingers, but it skittered away from her. She could hear Will screaming her name, calling her to throw it to him. She stretched her hand out farther, her fingers closing around the device. And then Nate seized her by one leg and dragged her back toward him, mercilessly.
"He is bigger than I am," she thought, "stronger than I am, more ruthless than I am. But there is one thing I can do that he cannot."
She changed. She reached out with her mind for the grip of his hand on her ankle, his skin touching her own. She reached out for the intrinsic, inborn Nate that she had always known. That spark inside him that flickered the way it did inside everyone, like a candle in a dark room. She heard him suck in his breath, and then the change took her, rippling her skin, melting her bones. The buttons at her collar and cuffs snapped as they grew in size, convulsions thrashing through her limbs, ripping her leg free of Nate's grasp. She rolled away from her brother, staggering to her feet, and saw his eyes widen as he looked at her. She was now, other than her clothes, an exact mirror image of himself. She whirled on the automaton. It was frozen, waiting for instructions, Will still clinging to its back. He raised his hand, and Tessa threw the device, silently thanking Gabriel and Gideon for the hours of knife-throwing instruction. It flew through the air in a perfect arc, and Will caught it out of the sky. Nate was on his feet.
"Tessa!"
he snarled.
"What in the bloody hell do you possibly think you're..."
"Seize him!" she shouted at the automaton, pointing at Nate.
"Catch him and hold him!"
The creature did not move. Tessa could hear nothing but Nate's harsh breathing beside her, and the sound of clanking from the metal creature. Will had vanished behind it and was doing something, though she could not see what.
"Tessa, you're a fool," Nate hissed. "This cannot work. The creature is obedient only to... I am Nathaniel Gray," she shouted up at the metal giant. "And I order you, in the name of the Magister, to seize this man and hold him."
Nate whirled on her.
"Enough of your games, you stupid little—"
His words were cut off suddenly as the automaton bent and seized him in its pincered grasp. It lifted him up, up, level with its slash of a mouth, clicking and whirring inquisitively. Nate began to scream and kept screaming, witlessly, his arms flailing as Will, finished with whatever he was doing, dropped to the ground in a crouch. He shouted something at Tessa, his blue eyes wide and wild, but she couldn't hear him over her brother's screams. Her heart was slamming against her chest. She felt her hair tumble down, hitting her shoulders with a soft, heavy weight. She was herself again. The shock of what was happening too great for her to hold on to the change. Nate was still screaming. The thing had him in a terrible pincer grip. Will had begun to run, just as the creature staring at Tessa reared up with a roar, and Will struck her, knocking her to the ground and covering her with his body as the automaton blew apart like an exploding star. The cacophony of bursting, clattering metal was incredible. Tessa tried to cover her ears, but Will's body was pinning her firmly to the ground. His elbows dug into the floor on either side of her. She felt his breath on the back of her neck, the pounding of his heart against her spine. She heard her brother cry out, a terrible gurgling cry. She turned her head, pressing her face into Will's shoulder as his body jacked against hers. The floor shuddered beneath them. And it was over. Slowly Tessa opened her eyes. The air was cloudy, with plaster dust and floating splinters and tea from the torn burlap sacks. Huge chunks of metal lay scattered haphazardly about the floor, and several of the windows had burst open, letting in foggy evening light. Tessa's glance darted about the room. She saw Henry, cradling Charlotte, kissing her pale face as she gazed up at him. Jem, struggling to his feet, steely in hand and plaster dust coating his clothes and hair. And Nate. At first, she thought he was leaning against one of the pillars. Then she saw the spreading red stain across his shirt and realized. A jagged chunk of metal had gone through him like a spear, pinning him upright to the pillar. His head was down, his hands clawing weakly at his chest.
Nate!
She screamed. Will rolled sideways, freeing her, and she was on her feet in seconds, racing across the room to her brother. Her hands were shaking with horror and revulsion, but she managed to close them around the metal spear in his chest and pull it free. She threw it aside and barely succeeded in catching him as he slumped forward, his sudden dead weight bearing her to the ground. Somehow, she found herself on the ground, Nate's limp body stretched awkwardly across her lap. A memory rose in her mind. Her crouching on the floor at De Quincey's townhouse, holding Nate in her arms. She had loved him then, trusted him. Now, as she held him, and his blood soaked into her shirt and trousers, she felt as if she were watching actors on a stage, playing parts, acting out grief.
Nate,
she whispered. His eyes fluttered open. A pang of shock went through her. She had thought he was already dead.
Tessie.
His voice sounded thick, as if it were coming through layers of water. His eyes roamed her face, then the blood on her clothes, and then finally came to rest on his own chest, where his blood pumped steadily through a massive rent in his shirt. Tessa shrugged off her jacket, wadded it up, and pressed it against the hard wound, praying it would be enough to make the blood stop. It wasn't. The jacket was soaked through instantly, thin wet streams of blood running down Nate's side.
Oh, God,
Tessa whispered. She raised her voice.
Will?
Don't. Nate's hands seized her wrist, his nails digging in.
But Nate...
I'm dying. I know. He coughed a loose, wet, rattling sound.
Don't you understand? I failed the Magister. He'll kill me anyway. And he'll make it slow.
He made a hoarse, impatient noise.
Leave it, Tessie. I'm not being noble. You know I'm not that.
She took a ragged breath.
I should leave you here to die, alone, in your own blood. That's what you'd do if it were me.
Tessie. A stream of blood spilled from the corner of his mouth.
The Magister was never going to hurt you.
Mortmain? She whispered.
Nate, where is he? Please, tell me where he is.
He, Nate choked, heaving in a breath. A bubble of blood appeared on his lips. The jacket in Tessa's hand was a sodden rag. His eyes went wide, starkly terrified.
Tessie, I'm dying. I'm really dying.
Questions still exploded through her head.
Where is Mortmain? How could my mother be a shadow hunter? If my father was a demon... How is it that I'm still alive when all the offspring of Shadowhunters and demons are stillborn?
But the terror in Nate's eyes silenced her. Despite everything, She found her hand slipping into his. There's nothing to be afraid of, Nate. Not for you, maybe. You were always the good one. I'm going to burn, Tessie. Tessie, where's your angel? She put her hand to her throat, a reflexive gesture. I couldn't wear it. I was pretending to be Jessamy. You must wear it. He coughed. More blood. Wear it always. You swear? She shook her head. Nate, I can't trust you, Nate. I know. His voice was a bare rattle. There's no forgiveness for the kinds of things I've had to do. She tightened her grip on his hand, her fingers slippery with blood. I forgive you, she whispered, not knowing or caring if it were true. His blue eyes widened. His face had gone the color of old yellow parchment, his lips almost white. You don't know everything I've done, Tessie. She leaned over him anxiously. Nate? But there was no reply. His face went slack, his eyes wide, half rolled back in his head. His hand slid out of hers and struck the floor. Nate? She said again, and put her fingers to the place where his pulse should have beat in his throat, already knowing what she would find. There was nothing. He was dead. Tessa stood up. Her torn waistcoat, her trousers, her shirt, even the ends of her hair, were soaked with Nate's blood. She felt as numb as if she had been dipped in ice-cold water. She turned, slowly, only now, and for the first time, wondering if the others had been watching her, overhearing her conversation with Nate, wondering. They weren't even looking in her direction. They were kneeling, Charlotte, Jem, and Henry, in a loose circle around a dark shape on the floor, just where she had been lying before, with Will on top of her. Will. Tessa had had dreams before in which she had been walking down a long, darkened corridor towards something dreadful, something she could not see but knew was terrifying and deadly. In the dreams, with each step, the corridor had gotten longer, stretching farther into the darkness and horror. That same feeling of dread and helplessness overwhelmed her now as she moved forward, each step feeling like a mile, until she had joined the circle of kneeling shadow hunters and was looking down at Will. He lay on his side. His face was white, his breathing shallow. Jem had one hand on his shoulder and was speaking to him in a low, soothing voice, but Will gave no sign of being able to hear him. Blood had pooled under him, smearing the floor, and for a moment Tessa just stared, unable to fathom where it had come from. Then she moved closer and saw his back. His gear had been shredded along his spine and shoulder blades, the thick material torn by flying shards of razored metal. His skin swam with blood. His hair was soaked with it. Will? Tessa whispered. She felt peculiarly dizzy, as if she were floating. Charlotte looked up. Tessa, she said, your brother. He's dead, Tessa said through her daze. But Will? He knocked you down and covered you to protect you from the explosion, Jem said. There was no blame in his voice. But there was nothing to protect him. You two were the closest to the blast. The metal fragments shredded his back. He's losing blood quickly. But there isn't anything you can do? Tessa's voice rose, even as dizziness threatened to envelop her. What about your healing runes? The Araxes? We used an Amissio, a rune that slows blood loss, but if we attempt a healing rune, his skin will heal over the metal, driving it farther into the soft tissue, said Henry, flatly. We need to get him back home to the infirmary. The metal must be removed before he can be healed. Then we must go. Tessa's voice was shaking. We must... Tessa, said Jem. He still had his hand on Will's shoulder, but he was looking at her, his eyes wide. Did you know you're hurt? She gestured impatiently at her shirt. This isn't my blood. This is Nate's. Now we must... Can he be carried? Is there anything? No, Jem interrupted, sharply enough to surprise her. Not the blood on your clothes. You've a gash on your head. Here. He touched his temple. Don't be ridiculous, Tessa said. I'm perfectly all right. She put her hands up to touch her temple and felt her hair thick and stiff with blood and the side of her face sticky with it. Before her fingertips touched the ragged flap of torn skin that ran from the corner of her cheek to her temple, a searing bolt of pain shot through her head. It was the last straw. Already weak from blood loss and dizzy from repeated shocks, she felt herself begin to crumple. She barely felt Jem's arms go around her as she fell into the darkness. Chapter 17. In Dreams. Come to me in my dreams, and then by day I shall be well again. For then the night will more than pay the hopeless longing of the day. Matthew Arnold. Longing.
Consciousness came and went in a hypnotic rhythm, like the sea appearing and disappearing on the deck of a boat in a storm. Tessa knew she lay in a bed with crisp white sheets in the center of a long room, that there were other beds, all the same, in the room, and that there were windows high above her, letting in shadows, and then the bloody light of dawn. She closed her eyes against it, and the darkness came again. She woke to whispering voices and faces hovering over her, anxious. Charlotte, her hair knotted back neatly, still in her gear, and beside her Brother Enoch. His scarred face was no longer a terror. She could hear his voice in her mind. The wound to her head is superficial. But she fainted, said Charlotte. To Tessa's surprise, there was real fear in her voice, real anxiety. With a blow to the head.